Establishes and till he makes Jerusalem a praise in the earth.
It shall come to pass in the latter days
that the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established on top of the mountains
and be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Out of Zion shall go forth the law
and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem.
And it shall come to pass that all nations shall come to Jerusalem year to year to worship the great King and to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. And from one new moon celebration to another, and from one Sabbath to another, all flesh shall come to worship before me, saith Yahweh.
Shalom. Welcome to TNT, to the Torah and the Testimony Revealed radio program. Today we're going to continue our Galatians series. This session will be session number 5, and we will finish up with chapter 3 of Galatians, and then go into a little bit of chapter 4. To begin our session, in Ivrim, Hebrews 10:1 of your Christian Bibles, you'll notice that it states that the earthly sanctuary with its sacrifices is referred to as the law. And so with this, it becomes evident, once again, that the phrase the law is not always referring to the same thing. Sometimes it is referring to the Torah, sometimes to the law of the accuser, the law of sin, and sometimes to the law of sacrifices, the law of the earthly sanctuary, which is added 430 years after the promise of Messiah given to Abraham. So as it states in Galatians 3:19, what purpose then did the law serve? Which law? Well, the law of the earthly sanctuary after the order of Levi and its accompanying sacrifices, which are only shadows of things yet to come, not the very things themselves. So verse 319a is more properly rendered, quote, what purpose then did the temple's sacrifices serve? Verse 19 continues, it was added because of transgressions to provide atonement for sin until the seed, who is Yeshua, could come to whom the promise was made, unquote. And which also is reflected in Ivrim, Hebrews 9:15. And at which time atonement would be replaced with what? With justification, and with the pouring out of the Ruach HaKadosh into the temple of our bodies. 3:21 states, is the law then against the promises of Yahweh? Which law? Well, the law of the temple sacrifices. The law of which Shaul is asking. Is the law of the sanctuary against the promises of Elohim? And he goes on in 3:21 to state, absolutely not. But if there had been a law of the temple sacrifices given which could have revived us, then truly pardon the acquittal would have come through that law. But, he goes on, the scripture has confined all under sin, so that through faith in the Messiah Yeshua, the promise might be given to those who believe in what? In his sacrifice. Who believe that Yeshua is the ultimate sin offering, presented by Yahweh himself, of which all the other sacrifices were foreshadowed and ultimately fulfilled through and in him. But before faith came, faith in what? Faith in Yeshua. We were protected under the law. Which law? The law of sacrifices. Embraced together for the faith which would afterwards be revealed. And 3:24 says that this law of the temple, was given as a tutor and instructor to lead us to Messiah so that we might be ultimately pardoned and acquitted through faith in him. But now that the way of faith in him has been brought to pass, we are no longer under the tutor. If you want to know in greater detail what this message in Galatians chapter 3 is talking about, just read the book Ivrim, Hebrews, chapter 6:19 through 10:29, and you'll find there are 5 chapters of explanation that state precisely what I've just said in today's teaching. So today we're not priests after the order of Levi, but priests after the order of Melchizedek. And as such, when the millennial temple is raised up, it's going to be ruled with priests who are immortal, with those of us who were resurrected, as it says in the scriptures, that those who are the first resurrection will reign with Messiah as kings and as priests for 1,000 years over the earth. Okay, who was Melchizedek? He was a king and a priest. Who is Yeshua? He is a king and he is a priest. King of kings and priest of priests. Your translation probably says King of kings and Lord of lords. Okay, but he's priest of priests. And will be priest over this temple. And so it's what we have, basically, in this teaching, is a replacement of the administration of the temple and its sacrifices by mortal men, who are just priests, but not kings, with a priesthood that is administered by immortal men, who are sinless, and who are ruling the earth as both kings and priests over the mortals that remain on the earth, who have not been brought to salvation yet. Okay, so today, as I just said, we are not priests after the order of Levi, but priests after the order of Melchizedek, as it is written in Shemot, Exodus 19, 5 and 6. If you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests, a set-apart nation. And as Kepha, Peter confirms in 1 Kepha, 1 Peter 2, 9, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and a set-apart nation, and his own special people. And that is written in Revelation 26 that I just mentioned. Blessed are they who have part in the first resurrection. Over such a second death has no power, but they shall be priests of Yahweh and of Messiah, and shall reign with him for 1,000 years. And as 14:12 says, here is the patience of the saints, of the set-apart ones. Here are those who obey the commandments of Yahweh and have the faith of Yeshua, the Torah and the testimony. If anyone does not speak according to these words, it is because they have no light in them. That's Yeshayahu, Isaiah 8:20. And you, my friends, as it says in Galatians 3:26-29, are all children of Yahweh through this same faith in Yeshua's sacrifice, who obey the commandments of Yahweh, and who have been pardoned and acquitted through your faith and trust in him. And if you belong to Yeshua, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. And it shall all states in 1 Corinthians 12:2, you are no longer foreigners from the nations. You are no longer Gentiles. So, now we enter into chapter 4, and let's see how this continues to unfold and progress. Chapter 4, verse 1 and 2, state, now I say that the heir, as long as he is a child, does not differ at all from a slave, though he will ultimately be master of all, but is likewise under protectors and supervisors until the time appointed by the father. Verses 4, 1 and 2 are describing Yeshua, how even though he would be the ultimate heir himself, even he had to be raised under similar conditions as we, and be subject to the same influences as we, until the appointed time, the time of his resurrection and ascension to the Father. Then in 4, verse 3 and 4, it goes on by stating, even so we, when we were children, were enslaved to the immature things of the world. But when the fullness of the time had come, Yahweh sent his Son, born of a woman, born under the temple sacrifices. And these sacrifices offered up at the temple were ordained into service 430 years after the promise of Messiah given to Abraham, and were provided as a temporal shadow of the heavenly sanctuary and priesthood to come to that promised Messiah. And Sha'ol described this law of sacrifices governing the earthly sanctuary and priesthood after the order of Levi as what? As a tutor, leading us to Yeshua. And so Yeshua was born under what? Under the tutor, so that he could redeem those who were under the tutor. Why did those under the tutor need to be redeemed? Because under the tutor, only atonement, that is, only cancellation and payment of debts could be made. But it could do nothing to render us innocent in light of our past guilt. It was like being released from prison after paying our debt to society, but without eliminating our past record of guilt, still archived in the court record. It was not until the death and resurrection of Yeshua that we could be justified, that is, could be pardoned and acquitted of our guilt. And it wasn't until we could be pardoned and acquitted of our guilt that the continuous indwelling of the presence of the Ruach HaKadosh could be given so that, as chapter 4, verse 5-7 state, we could receive the adoption of sons. And because you are sons, Yahweh sent forth the Ruach through his Son into the core of your being, crying out, Abba, Father. Therefore, you are no longer slaves, but sons, and if a son, then an heir of Yahweh through Yeshua. Now, before we go into verse 4:8, we need to clarify who the audience is that is being addressed. The assemblies in Galatia were predominantly Gentile converts, that is, they were foreigners being grafted in the national olive tree of Israel, of which Yeshua is king, and Elohim's law, the Torah, the standard of right conduct, the Constitution. In the analogy just presented in Galatians 4:1-7, Sha'ol was referring to these converts from the nations in place and time as those who have placed themselves, or who are seeking to place themselves, under the tutor by persuasion of the traditionalist, of those who are called the circumcision. But in the next analogy, Sha'ol is speaking in place and time to the converts from the nations in reference to their former lives as Gentiles prior to the conversion to any biblically based faith, which is confirmed in the following verse, Galatians 4:8, which says, but then, indeed, when you did not know Yahweh, you served those things which by nature are not God's. Now, this verse is referring to the idol-centered worship of the non-Jewish pagan religions that these foreign Gentile converts had come out of. You see, it is plain here that Shaul is addressing an audience of foreigners who had converted from paganism to the faith of Avraham, revived through Moshe and preserved through Judah, Yeshua, and the emissaries. For he says, when you did not know Yahweh, did not know Elohim, which Elohim? The Elohim of Israel, of course. The Elohim of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. When they did not know our Elohim. Why? Because before the conversion, they were servants to the gods of the foreign nations. But now, they have come to know the Elohim of Israel, the Elohim of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, have come to know Yahweh. Or as Shaul says, have come to be known by Yahweh, the Elohim of Israel. Why? Because they have converted from paganism to worship the one and only true Elohim, Yahweh, our Elohim. As Shaul says in 1 Corinthians 12:2, you know that you were once a people of the nations, carried away by lifeless idols. And then continuing on in Galatians 4:9 and 10, Shaul then says, but now, after you have known Yahweh, or rather are known of Yahweh, why is it that you turn again to the powerless and inadequate things of the heavenly bodies to which you desire again to be enslaved? For you continue to observe the days and months and seasons and years. Days and months and seasons and years of what? Of Elohim's calendar? Or of the pagan calendar? Of the pagan calendar, of course, and Shaul fears for them that perhaps his ministry to them has been in vain. These powerless and inadequate observations of the heavenly bodies that they previously engaged in mark a reference to the high places, the observatories previously used by them as pagans for observation of the stars, for the determination of destiny, for the setting of their celebrations and fertility rites, and that were used in conjunction with the previous worship of the false gods. For example, they used the calculation of the vernal equinox to set the time for the celebration of the fertility goddess Ishtar and her egg-laying Ishtar bunny, and the winter solstice they used to set the December 25th celebration of Tammuz, Mithras, the sun god, at the time of the Roman Saturnalia festival, known today as Christmas. The calculations of which the Israelites themselves had incorporated into the Hebrew calendar from the time of Babylon, even extending to Yeshua's day and up to the present, the vernal equinox and winter solstice, of which Yeshua himself never went by, as is evident in the timing of Yeshua's Passover celebrations. See our study entitled On Passover and the Resurrection for more on this subject. You see, now that Shaul has presented what it is that pardons and acquits us of sin and draws from that conclusion, what it is that makes us children of the Most High Elohim, and what doesn't, now Shaul is changing his focus to what kind of conduct is expected of those who are part of Yahweh's family, because many of them are still hanging on to their pagan past. Similar to how people coming out in our own generation oftentimes want to continue to hold on to its pagan celebrations of Ishtar, Christmas, pork consumption, and worship, as the Pope has declared it, on the venerable Day of the Sun. And the pig correlated in all this with the death of the cursed deity Tammuz during Christmas at the winter solstice, and with his reincarnation during the time of the cursed deity Ishtar at the vernal equinox. It's just human nature to want to hold on to those things which are familiar in Yahweh in times past has winked at our ignorance, but the time is now arriving for men everywhere to repent. For where righteous men go, virtuous women will follow. Now Galatians 4 continues on from verse 4:12, where Shaul urges them to be as he is and reminds them of their zealousness in the past. And as we continue to verse 4:17, we see that Shaul is not blaming them for their regression back into former practices, but shows his understanding of their temptation to withdraw when stating, quote, they zealously court you for no good purpose, that they want to exclude you, that you may be zealous for them. Who are they? They are the traditionalists, those of the old school of circumcision, required for participation in the temple sacrifices. The believers who are insisting that converts from among the nations have no salvation if they are not participating in the temple sacrifices, the act of which requires the circumcision of conversion. This teaching by the traditionalists was no doubt very confusing to the people being grafted in from the nations. Think about it. These are new converts from paganism who sometimes had little to no knowledge of Elohim of Israel prior to the conversion, and when they converted, they had the emissaries, on the one hand, stating that salvation and remission of sins concerning their past sinful behavior is through the blood of sacrifice of Yeshua. On the other hand, the believing Pharisees and traditionalists, who were still entrenched in the old school of thought, said no. Belief in Yeshua alone is not sufficient for salvation and remission of sin, because you must first be converted and offer sacrifices before you can receive any salvation from him. And do you know what often happens to new converts and young believers when they see conflict or find confusion in their new environment? Well, they back off and shy away, back into the world that they are more familiar with, and into the old environment they were once secure in. This explains why some may have been turning back to their old pagan ways. And it is true to this very day. I cannot even begin to count how many times I have seen new believers leave various churches and other assemblies and go back to their former lifestyles because the church, with all its conflicting doctrines, confused them and provided them with no sense of security. And when people feel uncomfortable, confused, or insecure in their new environment, it is simply human nature to want to return to those things that are more familiar. So here is Shaul, from Galatians 4:8-20, dealing with this very same issue, and he fears that his labor concerning some of them may be in vain. That is, that some of them may be persuaded by the inaccurate conclusions of the traditional positions, causing them to lose faith in Yeshua as the sole justification for their sins. And that others, discouraged by the division of thought, may have just simply left the faith to return to the security of the more familiar pagan rituals of their past. And so Shaul says in Galatians 4:21-22, quote, "Tell me, you who desire to be under the law." Well, which law? The law of circumcision for conversion and salvation through the work of animal sacrifices. Continuing on, "Do you not hear the law?" Which law? Well, the law of Torah. Written where? In the Torah. So, chapter 4, verse 21 is more properly rendered as what? As, "Tell me, you who desire to be under the temple sacrifices, do you not hear the Torah? For it is written that Avraham had two sons, one by the slave woman and the other by the free woman." That is, the son born of the slave woman was born as a result of human effort, but the son born of Sarah, the free woman, was born as a result of Yahweh's promise, apart from human effort, which things are symbolic. You see, Shaul is presenting another analogy to explain himself, this analogy paralleling the human effort represented by the son born of Hagar with those seeking atonement through the circumcision of conversion and sacrificial works offered up at the earthly sanctuary and priesthood, and paralleling the child born by promise apart from human effort with justification through the blood of Yeshua, that is, with pardon and acquittal through Yeshua, the seed of the promise of the covenant made with Abraham. And he goes on and states, "For there are two sons and two covenants, as it states in chapter 4:24, the one at Mount Sinai, which gives birth to bondage, and which corresponds to Hagar, refers to that which was given at Mount Sinai 430 years after the promises given to Abraham. And what was that thing that was given at Mount Sinai that was not given to Abraham? It is the earthly sanctuary and national priesthood that was added to the covenant, and which was added to respond to the issue of sin until Yeshua, the promised seed, could come." Shaul continues and says, "To this Hagar, which correlates to Mount Sinai, corresponds to Jerusalem, which is now in bondage with her children," in verse 4:25. In bondage to what? In bondage to the idea that the sacrifice of animals is superior to or equal to Yeshua's sacrifice, that the earthly high priest was superior to or equal to Yeshua as high priest, and that the earthly sanctuary of the temple was superior to or equal to the heavenly sanctuary. They wanted to take the new wine and place it into old wineskins. They didn't want to part from their temporal traditions, any more than Christianity was to depart from its pagan roots, passed down to them through the Catholic Church, the Universal Church of Rome. Now, let me give you a contemporary analogy of this scenario. Let's say that Abraham was a tent dweller, and that the promised seed would be a master carpenter who would ultimately provide all his descendants with mansions to live in. But let's say that promised master carpenter to come is not going to be due on the scene for another 1,800 years or so. Meanwhile, Abraham's small family and tent community grow into a nation of several million descendants who need something more than tents to dwell in. But the master carpenter is still not due to arrive for another 1,400 years. So Elohim says to Abraham's descendants, "I tell you what, I'm going to give you some land with permanent dwellings on it that you can call your own. Now these homes I will give you are only shadows of the mansions I will provide to you at that time." So 1,400 years later, the master carpenter arrives prepared to build their mansions, and many people are excited to put him to work on their new home. But others, who are not entirely convinced of his credentials, state they'd rather just have their old and rather small home simply remodeled, while discouraging others to hire him on. And yet others don't believe he is a master carpenter at all, and not only refuse to have anything to do with him, but threaten those who do because he poses a threat to their own construction investments. You see, there are those who believe wholeheartedly, those who don't believe at all, and then there are those, like those being addressed in Galatians, who believe Yeshua is the Messiah, but who want to continue to do things the traditional way, who want to discourage the wholehearted believers from adopting any custom that goes contrary to the current traditions, especially any they themselves are heavily vested in. But Shaul assures them in verse 4:28, stating, "But we, brethren, as Yitzhak, Isaac was, are sons of the promise." That is, we are those who are pardoned and acquitted through Yeshua, and not through the temple sacrifices, which could only atone for sin, but which did not have the power to pardon and acquit us of our sin. And in verse 4:29, Shaul points out how he, who is born out of the human effort, persecuted he who is born according to the Ruach, according to the promise. Then he reminds them in verse 430 and says, what did the scripture say? Cast out the slave woman and her son, for the son of the slave woman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, he continues, we are not sons of the slave woman, but of the free. And in verse 5:1, which should have been made verse 4:32, he says, stand firmly, therefore, in the freedom by which Yeshua has made us free, and do not be entangled again with a yoke of bondage. Notice that Shaul says, a yoke of bondage, referring to any yoke of bondage, whether it be the bondage of past pagan beliefs, or the bondage of traditions perpetuated by the traditionalists that kept people blind to Yeshua as being what the earthly sanctuary, sacrifices, and priesthood were all pointing to. Then in verse 5:2, Shaul comes full circle in his discussion beginning from verse 2:3, and which stemmed from the question raised in Acts 15:1-2, and concludes, indeed, I, Shaul, say to you that if you become circumcised, that is for this purpose of engaging in the temple sacrifices, that the Messiah will be of no advantage to you. No advantage to you concerning what? Concerning salvation. That is, no advantage concerning what justifies and acquits us of our past violations of Torah. So, if all this is true, then why did Shaul himself offer up sacrifices on at least two different occasions when taking a Nazirite vow? Because the issue of salvation and circumcision was concerning the people from the nations who had never partook in the temple sacrifices prior to the knowledge of salvation in Yeshua, not concerning Paul or his fellow Jewry who had grown up with the sacrifices and who were able to see clearly Yeshua's representation in those sacrifices and whose faith was actually enhanced by that correlation in that knowledge that they had, having been raised under that system. So for them, Yahweh provided a 40-year transitionary period to work their way out from under that system, which had become second nature to them. But until that transitionary period from 30 CE to 70 CE was passed, it remained acceptable for those who had become believers through that system of sacrifices, through that tutor, to continue to partake of that system with which they were familiar, and which helped them to bring them to their knowledge of Yeshua under that former covenant. But for the people of the nations, the new covenant confirmed in the blood of Yeshua was the only option for them, and after 70 CE, 68 on the corrected calendar, it likewise became the only option for Jews and Israelites as well. Okay, so that's all we have time for today. So please join us next time on our Galatians series. So until then, shalom, shalom, and blessings in the name of our wondrous Redeemer, Yeshua our Messiah.
Thank you for joining us for the Torah and the Testimony Revealed radio program. The text version of this program is available on our website at www.jewsforyeshua.com. That's www.jewsforyeshua.com. That's Yeshua, spelled Y-E-S-H-U-A. Please join us again next time to learn more about the Torah and the Testimony Revealed in Scripture, right here at the Hebrew Nation radio station. Shalom.